See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 347. Tuesday, October 8th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and as people who watch my videos know, I have some dental issues which have gone unaddressed for too long, and they've come to a point now where I absolutely have to take action in order to avoid some really, really bad outcomes. I'd put out a video about that, because, you know, I do a video every day, and when you do something every day, I end up talking about things that I wouldn't talk about if I were, you know, recording them as a podcast and then deciding in the editing whether or not to leave it. It was not my intention to ask for help. But two Sea Realm Vault podcast subscribers and longtime friends of the Sea Realm sent me unsolicited donations, you know, to help with the dental issue. So special thanks to Daniel and Kevin. Very tellingly, they both sent the donations via PayPal. Somebody who just knows me from my YouTube work wouldn't have any reason to think about sending me money via PayPal or what email address would be associated with my PayPal account. I do talk about my Patreon account from time to time, so somebody could make a donation through there. But given that these both came in through PayPal, this tells me that these are longtime friends and supporters of the Sea Realm, which, you know, I knew anyway. I recognize their names. But the help is very much appreciated. As of right now, I am still making sounds by pushing my tongue to my actual teeth. But in the near future, you will hear me speaking with prosthetic teeth, which will not be functional for eating, but they will be functional for speaking. In the distant, distant future, when I am allowed to travel internationally again, I intend to go to Latin America and seek out, you know, actual dental prosthetics that are fully functional. But that's probably a few years off. And I was thinking, I actually made this decision while I was in the dentist chair, semi-inverted, you know, with somebody's hands in my mouth, poking and prodding and scraping. I was thinking, you know, I could just have the teeth removed and not get the prosthetic, because the prosthetic is mostly cosmetic, won't be functional for eating. It's going to cost more for the prosthetic than it will for, you know, the extractions. Maybe I should just do without it. Maybe I should just have, you know, a chunk of missing teeth in the front on the bottom. And what made me decide, no, it's worth going into debt to get this prosthetic, as I imagined my dealings with police. If I ever had to deal with police outside of Bellows Falls, you know, because I'm known here, but if I ever had to deal with police who didn't know me, and I had visibly missing teeth, they would make assumptions about me that would not be in my favor. They could go extremely poorly. And as quickly as, you know, involuntary interaction with the medical establishment can just devastate one financially, the same is true of involuntary interactions with the legal establishment, with the criminal justice system. The difference being that police can kill you. They can take a gun from a holster, point it at you, and put bullets in your body and kill you. So it is definitely wise. It would be money better spent to prevent that than it would be to try to seek redress in court after the fact, assuming I survived the encounter. So I am going into debt to get fake teeth. That is not the topic of this episode of the podcast, however. What I have for you is the conclusion of my conversation with a millennial. I mentioned a while back that I don't know very many millennials. And Philip in Baltimore stepped forward to offer his perspective. I did a video for YouTube within the last few days. You know, doing them every day, I completely lose track of them. But I was basically reporting on some reading that I had done about the financial fortunes of the millennials, and they do split into two very distinct groups, at least two, possibly more, and certainly more. But the main two I'm thinking of are, you know, those who go to college and those who don't, because the economy has morphed under our feet. It has gone in my lifetime from being something that anybody with, you know, a reasonable amount of self-discipline and willingness to show up to a job every day, you know, could plug into without too much effort and certainly without a college degree and, you know, enter into the middle class, maybe not the upper middle class, but, you know, better than the working poor. It was, you know, in no way unusual for people with just a high school education to start a job, work it for decades, in the process, send kids to college, buy a house, buy cars, go on vacations. I mean, that was not considered exceptional. Today, that is exceptional. We have a skill-biased economy whereby enormous resources are devoted to attracting and retaining people with certain technical skills. And for everybody else, compensation has either stagnated or is declining. And certainly companies have decided that it's much better to hire somebody as a contractor rather than actually take responsibility for them as an employee. Some states and some countries are pushing back against this, but it hasn't reversed the trend. It hasn't even really slowed it significantly. Now, my situation is certainly unique. Well, not unique, but it's definitely not the norm. You know, I create media for subscribers like you, but also for people who pay me, you know, to do so, and they distribute it without my name attached to it. You know, so it's not KMO personality, you know, appearing on camera or speaking or whatnot. I'm talking about the comic, you know, the Geb comic strip, which is about half of my income at this point. And I'm not credited as the author of that strip. And in fact, I don't own the characters. I don't own the intellectual property. It's basically work for hire, but I'm not an employee. I'm a contractor. The same is true of the video work that I do for the local community TV station here. You know, I get paid a flat fee to take video equipment to some public event, film it, and bring the equipment and the recording back. Actually, ironically, that to me is not a very creative thing. The major piece of work is just doing the setup of the video equipment, the travel, and then just being present for all of these long, tedious, repetitive, boring meetings. But I do get credited on these things. If you go to the Fact TV website and you call up any recording of some meeting that I always want to say filmed, but there's no film involved, at which I have manned the camera, you will see that I'm given a credit at the beginning of the video, which to me is unnecessary but fun. But the point is, you know, having income from a variety of streams like this does not bring with it all the benefits that come from full-time employment, where one is considered an employee of a corporation or a company. It's particularly difficult when it comes time to access healthcare, and it's very difficult at tax time. And yet, more and more people are entering into situations like mine where they don't have the support of an employer. They do have a variety of income streams and really no easy avenue for gaining the sorts of assistance and support that an employer would normally provide. And normally definitely goes into emboldened scare quotes there, as that situation, which was normal when I was young, is definitely not normal now. So the millennials, getting back to the topic at hand, the millennials basically bifurcate into two main streams, those who get post-secondary education and those who do not. And those who do not, they face basically a future like the one I'm living now. It is not easy. It is certainly not easy to earn a living the way I do and have a family. And yet, in my experience, it is the millennials who have the least security and the least order in their lives and the least expectation for future prosperity who are the most willing to have children. That's certainly the case here in rural Vermont. So let's get into the conversation with Philip, hear the end of it, and then I'll tell you about my other current obsessions here at the end. So the conceit for this conversation was I was going to talk to a millennial. So the millennials are born 1981 to 1996. When were you born?
I was born in 88, so I'm right in the middle.
Right in the middle. You are the definitive millennial.
At least by age. Maybe not by other things, but at least by age.
Well, where do you think you wouldn't be a millennial?
Well, I'm sorry, I am a millennial, but I was fortunate to grow up in a pretty upper middle class background. So even when millennials have gone to college at much higher rates, I believe, than previous generations and traveled more and all that. But still, I would think that the median millennial hasn't gone to college, that there really are only so many of us who have a degree. So there's that. I feel pretty economically secure, which, as I sort of alluded to earlier, I'm kind of surprised with how I've been able to do in my career. I didn't think that I was going to have the sort of standard of living that my parents did, but I'm doing okay. I have tons of student loans, so lots of my income goes to that. But yeah, I do have a millennial experience in many ways.
You know, Andrew Yang, when he's talking about his student loans and his experience of trying to pay them off, he described his loans as his mistress, because he was, you know, it was as if he was writing a check to support this this other family that he was keeping in another city.
Yeah, my minimum payment of my student loans is about $100 short of my mortgage, I think.
So yeah, you also have a mistress.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I'm trying to pay them down even faster to just get rid of them, because it's just a burden. Yeah, I think about it all the time. And I studied abroad for a semester in college in Denmark. And wow, to hear that they not only get free college and graduate school up to age 26, but they get a stipend to do it. And telling them how much I was going to owe when I was done with my education, they were blown away. I mean, it's just insane. And I don't know what the answer is. I went to a private university and I thought it was a really great experience that I sort of got to live in a little cultural niche with a bunch of nerds like myself. And I think that I try to think about whether that would be possible if we just had a entirely state or nationally run university system, whether we could still have those same sorts of cultures and experiences. Would students still be living on campus in the numbers that they do now, or would it be more like Europe where they're just living in the town or city nearby? I would like to think there's a way to get the best of both worlds, but I don't know. And universities and hospitals both drive our economy these days. And certainly here in Baltimore, our two largest employers are Johns Hopkins University and Johns Hopkins Medical Center. It's really hard to really make meaningful reform to reduce the price of education.
I live about an hour south of Dartmouth, New Hampshire. Or, you know, it's Hanover, New Hampshire's the town, but really Dartmouth is the point on the map. It's Dartmouth University. And there is a big hospital in the town as well. So everybody who lives there works either for the university or the hospital.
Eds and meds.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's, you know, education, I think, obviously adds to our economy. It increases skills and makes us, our workforce, better and enables us to do more things. But healthcare, it's just fixing problems, really. I mean, it's amazing that we have, the sort of fastest growing sector of our economy, or one of them, is just about fixing people, you know? It's really weird when you think about it. I think that's one of the reasons why people are always wanting manufacturing to come back, because we just think, well, how can we really be a country that's a successful, you know, nation and economy if we're not making stuff, if we're not providing for people's material needs? It's rather odd, the age we live in.
That it is, and I think it's going to get more odd. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the current electoral cycle. In 2016, really, the expectation, I think, in the part of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party was that she would have a couple of token you know, competitors in the very early stages of the primary, but then they would drop out and it would just be her.
Yeah.
And they were pretty, you know, upset and put out and offended that Bernie Sanders actually presented an ongoing serious challenge. Well, now we've got a, you know, a completely different situation where we've got this huge slew of, you know, of candidates who want to be the Democratic nominee, so many that until this most recent debate, they had to spread debates out over two nights. And, you know, it, Bernie Sanders is among them now, but he doesn't have, I mean, his support has been divided by, in, you know, to a lot of different candidates. What do you see? How does this appear to you, you know, given your position, your history with, you know, watching political campaigns and watching the social phenomenon that takes, that comes up around them?
Yeah, it's remarkable how fractured it is. I think that the Democratic race now has more in common with, I guess, the Republican race last time, that there were a lot of Republican candidates. Now, Trump stood out among them pretty early on, but, I mean, Biden is very strong too. It is difficult to watch the debates. I think the last one was 2.5 hours. I mean, I had to break it up over a couple days to get through it. It's crazy. You know, there's just so many people on stage, and it is very interesting to see how each of the candidates is targeting a particular demographic. And for most of them, it's very easy to see who they're trying to get. But that's not a really a winning strategy. I mean, that's speaking to a base who maybe will get you some enthusiastic volunteers or campaign staffers to help increase your reach. But it just seems like the people they're talking to is too narrow. And the folks who are trying to speak really broadly, like Buttigieg, they come across as sort of empty and like not really having new and innovative ideas. And for someone who actually does care about policy, it's discouraging to see those who have really the least to offer in that arena doing the best. I think the best mix of this would be Warren and Sanders, who both have extensive platforms, really great policies that I would support. But still, because the field is so big, they're at, I don't know, the upper teens in the percent that they have, I think, added together.
Right,
they're
numbers 2 and 3. You know?
Yeah, right. I mean, the DNC has their ways of narrowing this down. So far, I think it's been fine. I was really excited about Inslee because of his Green New Deal platform that just seemed above everyone else. But I understood why he had to go. And I'm hoping that the field will continue to be winnowed without a lot of decorum and just nasty public debate. I mean, I remember the Bernie versus Hillary sort of online discourse was really toxic, and I don't want that again.
Well, we've got it again. The Bernie versus Andrew Yang online, it is just as toxic. It is every bit as acrimonious, with insults being thrown back and forth, and I don't participate in it, but it is a pain to witness it.
They're not going to change each other's minds. It's remarkable how much effort and just mental energy people will put into tweets at each other that really aren't going to make a difference.
Yep. And, you know, I read Andrew Yang's book, The War on Normal People, and it really spoke to a lot of issues that I'm passionate about. So, you know, he was my candidate, and I started doing videos about his positions. And, you know, it's just not in me to be an uncritical rah-rah supporter. So I'm going to examine things. And, you know, in talking about Andrew Yang, but failing to be that uncritical rah-rah, you know, advocate, I got accusations from, you know, the true believer Yang fans that I was a crypto Bernie bro, you know, that I'm pretending to support Yang, but really I'm just there to, you know, criticize him and run him down. So there's an element of true believerism in the Yang gang that, no, I understand it, but at the same time, you know, I'm in my 50s now, and I've been through many electoral cycles, and I know that the person who seems like the dream candidate just doesn't win. They just don't. You know, they don't get the nomination. And the one exception to that, was Barack Obama. And, you know, he was such a great disappointment when he actually got into office and he behaved, you know, he kept key members of the Bush cabinet, you know, and
yeah, right.
Took the baton from the Bush administration and ran with it just like they would have. And, you know, so I've been trying to, it for a little bit, I was trying to say, hey, look, guys, you know, I'm not trying to be an asshole about this, but I just want to, you know, prepare you that this level of idealism that you're displaying right now is setting yourself up for extreme disappointment and extreme like alienation in the not too distant future. Try to take a sip of reality, you know?
Yeah, sure is. It's hard to be that voice. I'm wondering if it's, I've read Andrew Yang's platform really because of you. And at first I wrote the guy off. I thought, well, tech guy, we don't really need that right now. But the platform is very interesting. But I haven't had experience with the online culture. And does it resemble Ron Paul's sort of supporter base at all? Or who are the Yang gang in terms of demographic? Well,
most of his support, I think, comes from the fact that he is attracting people who have never been interested in politics or are long since like tuned out and disaffected and alienated. And, you know, they hear this person who is speaking in a way that is very different from most other candidates. And he is so different that, you know, it really stands out, which is why they don't let him talk on the debate stage. And so I think, I would guess that most of Ron Paul's supporters, and I have voted for Ron Paul in primaries before, are either Republicans who just don't like the neocon, you know, imperial ambition. They want to be more inward focused, you know, more domestic sort of focused Republicans, or they're libertarians, you know, who see a libertarian, a principled libertarian streak in what Ron Paul has to say.
Yeah.
That was my attraction to him. And I think that Ron Paul supporters tend to be probably more, you know, more ideologically sophisticated than Yang supporters. Yang supporters, I think, mostly see him as like a life preserver. You know, they are drowning, they are desperate, and they see somebody. I mean, there's a real messianic feel to how they talk about him and treat him online. And that's why I say, you know, even if he wins, he can't possibly live up to your expectations. And the chances that he's going to win in this cycle are minuscule. Absolutely minuscule. Weird, weird stuff would have to happen for him to pass the front runners, particularly Biden. Although I think Biden is, there's a very strong chance that he is going to utterly self-destruct on the campaign trail. He was so discombobulated on stage in this last debate. He just doesn't seem to be up to the task.
He sure was. I mean, I used to really admire the guy. I mean, I still do, but he just doesn't seem fit to hold the job anymore. I don't think. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but hey, I looked it up the other day because I was curious what percentage of millennials support Biden, and the figure I saw was 8%. Yeah, I don't know anybody who is. I mean, I know people who like the sort of folksiness of Biden and he's a relatable guy, but I don't think I know any true supporters.
Well, here's what I've noticed about Biden is that he gets into this mode where he takes on this sort of scolding tone, and he's sort of a prophet, you know, not like he's predicting the future, but like he's scolding his own society and telling them what's wrong with it. And when he gets into that mode, his command of facts just completely goes out the window. Like his ability to concentrate on what he's talking about gets scrambled. But the emotional intensity is engaged. And if he's talking to an audience who doesn't know the facts or doesn't care about the facts, they don't notice that cognitively he has gone off the rails, because he is well-spoken and he is very charismatic and, you know, he looks good. So if you're not politically tuned in most of the time, you just tune in, you know, during the electoral cycles to decide who you like, I can easily see, yeah, liking Joe Biden. And it's a name you've known forever. So, and he was, you know, Obama's vice president.
Yeah, so it's possible.
The appeal is obvious.
Boomers are still the largest voting block, right?
So, yeah, sure.
And that Biden would definitely be their candidate. Did you catch when he said something about record players during the debate. And I couldn't tell, was that just being really old, or was that just he couldn't remember his talking points? And
in the 80s and the 90s, there was a belief that if you played classical music to young children, that it increased their IQ.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a government program that gave out cassette players with classical music on cassette to, you know, so-called underprivileged mothers to play
no
to their
way.
Kids. Yeah. Huh. I think that's what he was talking about, but it was so random. He had basically drifted into free association word salad for a few seconds. I mean, he tightened up pretty quick, but yeah, no, I just don't see, he's going to require a lot of stage managing and a lot of forgiveness by the punditry to get him through this electoral cycle.
Yeah. The thing that I really, that really puts me off, and I think probably a lot of millennials, is that he just seems so out of touch with how politics is done now. It's like he still believes that he could sit down with Mitch McConnell over a steak dinner and they would work out America's problems and come to a compromise. It's not happening. It's just not happening.
No.
When I look at Andrew Yang's platform and I see that he wants to make Puerto Rico a state, and then I scroll down a little bit more and it says he wants to make Washington, D.C. a state. I'm like, yeah, okay, this guy gets it. Like, we need to actually fundamentally change how the Constitution governs our electoral politics. And we just can't get anything done with the status quo. And I don't know. There's just compromise in the Senate. It's not going to happen. Any candidate who's going to stand on that debate stage and say that's they're going to be their way of getting things done, I'm not voting for them.
Andrew Yang's, his website is kind of a strength, but it's also a weakness in that I've seen him interviewed where, you know, you can go into his 170 something policy proposals on his website.
It's huge.
And, yeah. But there's some kind of esoteric stuff in there. And what I saw, I think it was NBC did this. They went through and they picked out just some weird sounding things, put them all up on a slide together and said, this is Andrew Yang's, you know, platform. He believes in, he believes in unionization for mixed martial artists, and he wants to get rid of the penny, and he really likes self-driving cars, and that's his position. You know, that's his platform.
Yeah, right.
You know, they don't mention universal basic income. They don't mention Medicare for all.
It's like when AOC released a document that her staffers had put together, some talking points or something about a Green New Deal, and it mentioned hamburgers, and everyone's just like, okay, that's it. That's what the Green New Deal is about. No one's going to be able to eat hamburgers anymore. It's funny, like there were a lot of sort of those very small issues that I noticed on his platform. Another one was that NCAA athletes should be paid. And it's, well, yeah, they should. I mean, it's basically, you know, junior professional sports. And
they generate enormous fortunes for other people. They should get a little piece of it.
Yes. And that is, it's not our top national issue, but yeah, that is an issue. And why not put that in your platform? But it's easy for the media to just pick out those little things and lose sight of the big environmental platform or Medicare for All or UBI as way more important.
Another weird thing that the corporate media has done to undermine Andrew Yang is to pretend that they don't know his name and get his name wrong in a variety of weird ways. Like
how?
Well, he was crowd surfing at an event a week or so ago. And so that made the news. Just, you know, the video of him being passed around on the shoulders of the supporters in a crowd. I mean, can you imagine any of the other Democratic candidates on that debate stage, like going to the edge of the stage and turning his back to the stage and falling back into the crowd and just, you know, being passed hand over hand?
No, we can't.
So when one of the networks that reported on it, they identified him as John Yang. It's like, come on, he's... Not only is he, you know, a candidate, he's one of the candidates that actually made the cut when they went from two nights to one. He's still on stage. He has enough support. You should know his name.
Yeah, I agree. All the candidates who are on the stage now, there's no excuse. And if you're covering these things, you got to know their names.
So, how old are you?
I'm 31.
31.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were, you know, the idealistic college student for Obama in 2008. By 2012, you were kind of disillusioned. Then, you know, comes 2016. There's the whole, you know, the Democratic Party really kind of revealed themselves to be pretty corrupt and antagonistic toward democratic process, you know, among their own voters. And then 4 years of Trump. Where are you sitting in terms of your, you know, your attitude toward direct electoral democracy as it has played out in the United States?
I feel, I guess, pretty cynical about it. There are still candidates I get excited about, but it's hard to see myself campaigning for them in the same way that I did for Obama. I don't know. Long term, I would like to leave the U.S. if just for a little while. Actually, I was able to obtain Italian citizenship through my ancestry, and it took several years to get through the whole process. But now I have another passport, so I can go elsewhere potentially. Before Brexit, I was planning on potentially moving to the UK for a few years, but now that door is being closed, you know, if they ever leave anyway. I don't know. It's a struggle.
Well, I'm not going to venture any prediction as to what's going to happen with Brexit. I'm just, you know, I'm not on the ground there. I don't follow it closely enough to have an informed opinion. But I think in the long term, the UK will be better off with a strong relationship with the United States and some distance from Europe, because I think Europe's going to be increasingly just a mess.
Yeah, I'm worried about Europe too. You know, as part of becoming or being recognized as Italian dual citizen, I've started to follow their politics, and it's been just crazy with this. They put together this coalition government of two populist parties, one from the right, one from the left. They basically both agreed that they needed to slow or stop migration from Africa and the Middle East, but they didn't really agree on that much else. The government fell apart. Now the Salvini, the guy who's sort of their Trump, you know, anti-immigrant figure, was put out of power, and the government now is held up. The populists are supported by kind of the equivalent of our Democrats, sort of centrist neoliberals. And you get in these situations where there's this democratic disconnect where the largest party by polling is not the party in government. And it just seems like a big problem. And then when I look for, you know, forward, looking at climate change, the estimates of the number of migrants and refugees vary hugely. I mean, 25 million at the low end by 2050 and a billion at the high end, right? And something like 6 million people are refugees from Syria. And there's another like 5 million, I think, that are displaced internally. And look what that did to European politics. I mean, something that's many multiples in size of people trying to reach Europe, it's going to be, I don't even know. I mean, no one can really predict, but I don't think it's going to be pretty.
Well, you know, I keep coming back to Winston Churchill, who, I think it was Churchill, who said, democracy is the worst form of government ever tried, except for all the others.
Yeah, right.
Show me an alternative that has a track record of producing better results, and I'll give it a try. But I know of no such alternative.
No. I think there are lots of variations of democracy, and I would love to see Americans be more open to experimenting with other systems that might break the gridlock. But yeah, here, I don't know. When I was in Denmark, it was just this vision of this sort of social democrat or democratic socialist, you know, almost ideal society. But when I was there, I saw advertisements at the train stations that said, "Save our Denmark." And they were from the People's Party there that was really the leading anti-immigrant force in politics. And they've only grown since then. So even back then, you could see how the system was fracturing and really entering a new era.
Well, Denmark has, you know, the example of France just to their south, so they can see, you know, what an influx of immigrants that you basically just warehouse, you know, you don't make any real attempt to try to integrate them into your society or your economy. And as a body, they have no interest in integration. It's not a pretty picture.
Yeah. And Sweden too. Sweden and Denmark, you know, we as Americans, I think, just assume are very, very similar in politics, how they run their societies. But Sweden has took on more immigrants per capita, more refugees per capita than I think anyone in Europe. And they're not really that great at integrating them. You know, I think it's a wonderful thing to have a diverse society, but if you can't actually integrate people to achieve that, and you're just diversity by straight numbers and not by a real combined culture, that's just not good. And it just can't be good in the long term. I think in the United States, we take on fewer people from abroad, but we're a lot better at integrating them. You know, even Muslims, I mean, we've been known for having all these anti-Islamic policies and foreign interventions, but, and in terms of actually integrating people into our society, we do an okay job.
You know, when I lived in Brooklyn, I lived very close to where three neighborhoods came together. There was a Jewish Orthodox neighborhood, there was a Hindu neighborhood, and there was a Muslim neighborhood, and they were all right up next to one another. And there was never even a whiff of cultural tension or any threat of violence or anything like that on the street. I mean, they lived side by side, you know, in not perfect harmony, but not. I've certainly been in places in the U.S. where there was much more tension, you know, between different classes of people.
What do you think was the key to that being so successful? Yeah, yeah. Everybody's material needs are cared for, then you can integrate a lot better.
Yeah, so, you know, you're talking about the likelihood of a lot of climate refugees and migrants. You know, if we lived in a planet where we didn't have our sort of territoriality and tribal instincts, and we were, you know, all saw one another as being part of the same superorganism, we could probably move those people to new locations fairly easily. But, you know, that's not humanity. We are evolved to survive in small groups, and the main competition that we need those groups to, you know, to help us survive against are other groups of creatures just like ourselves. And I think that, you know, the war and the conflict that will arise from the need to move people around as a result of climate change is probably going to be a lot worse than the climate change itself in terms of, you know, the number of lives lost and the amount of human suffering, avoidable human suffering that takes place.
Yeah, it endures, right? In a ways that the latest natural disaster can sort of fade away for people who aren't living it directly. The sort of cultural and political implications of migrants moving across borders, that's something that more people will actually feel. So yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, it depends where you are, of course. There will be people who, you know, experience really tough drought for years and years and years, or extreme heat and floods and whatnot. It's already here to some extent. But yeah, the migration, that's the thing that gets me. And that's the one that I bring up with other people when I talk about climate change now, because I think that that's something that we can understand a little bit more. We can understand that even if you were to agree that everybody who's trying to get from the southern border should be let in and given a pass to citizenship and all that, you can still understand this is a big issue we have to grapple with. So it's kind of talking about the refugees and migrants. That's something I think that can cross political boundaries and talking to people and getting them to realize the impacts of climate change.
Well, Philip, we've been on for over an hour. We should probably wrap it up, but let me invite you to speak directly to your fellow CRealm Vault subscribers, many of whom are baby boomers. You know, so I'm a youngster compared to a good portion of this audience. What do you have to say to the boomers?
I think I'd like to see boomers open themselves back up to big ideas. You know, there was once a time in their lives when it seemed like society needed big sweeping changes. And to some extent, we had some of those. We need those again. We're facing all kinds of crises, and we need bold ideas. And, you know, if those are younger people who are putting those forward, I just ask for some consideration and support towards those ideas.
And what do you have to offer in return?
Well, good question. I guess, you know, it would be nice if there wasn't this sort of underlying conflict between our generations, and that we could sort of just get along a little bit more smoothly. And I mean, to be frank, our generation is needed to care for the baby boomers as they get older. So, you know, we really need to be complements to each other, I think, and moving forward.
And I'll break with media tradition and admit that there is a generation between the boomers and the millennials. Do you have anything to say to
yep.
Generation X?
Those forgotten Xers, yep. And then Z after the millennials. I'm very interested to see what, you know, where they go.
Do you call them Zoomers?
No, I don't think I've ever.
Oh, I hear that thrown around a lot.
Zoomers.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. I mean, they seem different from millennials in several ways, but I don't think we'll really see it until they come of age. So I look forward to seeing what that's all about. But I think the millennials will still be bigger, so we'll still be a larger voting block.
Oh, yeah. Now, you're a bigger demographic, no question. Yeah. All righty. Hey, Philip, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, that was Philip, a millennial friend of the Sea Realm, living in Baltimore, Maryland, and doing pretty well in terms, you know, in comparison to the majority of his age cohort. Because most people traditionally haven't gone to college. More millennials are going to college than in any previous generation, but still most of them don't. And of those who do, you know, before the conclusion of the interview, I talked about the two main streams of millennial fates, you know, those who go to college and those who don't. But even among those who go to college, those who acquired the technical expertise that our skill-biased economy rewards heavily, and those who get the sorts of generalized liberal arts degrees which imply a measure of personal responsibility and dedication to a task, but do not imply any, you know, particularly marketable technical skill, a lot of those folks are struggling. A lot of those folks are burdened by student debt that they just don't have the vocational means to pay off in any reasonable amount of time. This is debt that could dog their steps for most of their adult lives. And so from there, I'm going to segue into a suite of concerns that I address fairly frequently in the daily videos, but which I don't think I've really talked about much at all in podcast form, and where to start with it. Part of it is peak oil. I mean, I've certainly addressed in the podcast that I am no longer an adherent or, you know, a champion for the peak oil worldview. I think it is a narrative that has been thoroughly discredited. I think a much greater challenge that the United States in particular, but, you know, the industrialized world in general will face in the coming decades is how to equitably share a rush of newly created wealth, wealth that will largely come from machine learning and artificial intelligence and from, you know, the new rush of hydrocarbon energy being unleashed by the shale revolution, otherwise known as fracking. Although that's, you know, the more you study shale hydrocarbon production, the less likely you are, I think, to talk about fracking, because just fracturing shale or rock in order to release hydrocarbons is not a new technology. The shale revolution, I mean, fracturing shale is a piece of it, but also big and essential pieces of it involve figuring out where in a shale formation to drill. And this is a technological revolution in, among other things, seismology, using, you know, micro seismic sensors to figure out exactly where to drill. And then, you know, the peak oil folks, they I don't pay as close attention to them as I used to. But back when they were telling us that shale fracking would never scale up economically, you know, and provide any significant quantity of fossil fuels, one of the things they said, you know, the major talking point was the rapid depletion of fracked wells. Well, since then, the fracking industry and, you know, the petroleum geologists and the engineers have figured out how to go back and refrack the same well over and over again to drill new lateral lines at different levels in the strata and to locate, you know, the exact locations to frack to bring a new rush of hydrocarbons to the surface from that same well. And unfortunately, one of the tools that they have availed themselves of for, you know, accessing hydrocarbons from shale at a price point that makes sense given the current price of oil and natural gas is to use automation to eliminate expensive human labor wherever possible. And that trend, not only will it continue, it will accelerate. And so as more and more wealth is generated using machines, using algorithms, and using the vast majority of the hydrocarbon reserves of the earth, which until very recently we had no need to even try to figure out how to access, this is going to generate enormous wealth, and yet the economy is trending towards withholding that wealth from the vast majority of people and directing it to an ever-shrinking elite. Now, a lot of the folks listening to this who are comfortable probably wouldn't want to consider themselves part of any elite. I know that you can frame global wealth distribution in such a way that I myself am a member of a privileged elite. Certainly, you know, compared to somebody who's living on $2 a day in what we used to call the third world, I'm living a life of luxury. And that's, you know, that's an uncomfortable thing to come to grips with. And if we are seeing, you know, what some people have called the rise of the rest, if we're going to see a balancing, an averaging of wealth distribution around the world such that everybody has nearly equal access to a similar style of living, well, for those of us in the West, you know, for those of us in the United States, regardless of where we are compared to our fellow citizens here in the U.S. or England or Canada or Australia, our lifestyle would diminish considerably to arrive at the new global average. Unless, of course, we utilize technology and the energy resources available to us to vastly increase what is possible. When there are abundant food sources available, chimps behave like bonobos. When food sources are scarce, chimps factionalize, and they raid, and they murder, and they exhibit all the worst behaviors that we condemn in humanity. You know, all the behaviors that can be affected without advanced technology, and without the ability to, you know, abstract as with money. That invites, even, you know, without information technology beyond clay tablets, that invites, you know, a realm of a vice that chimps are at present not capable of. But I remember recording an interview in New York City, and I don't remember the guy's name. He was actually, he was an evangelist for technology that seemed kind of spooky to me. But we talked about these topics, and, you know, he said, we absolutely have to make more fruit. There's no way we can divide the existing bounty in such a way that, you know, it is equally distributed to anybody's satisfaction. The bounty must be increased considerably. And we have to do it in a way that respects the climate, respects the planet. And I certainly hope that we can do it in a way that respects non-human life on Earth. I think we have to some extent. You know, we are not self-sufficient unto ourselves, biologically speaking. Even within our own bodies, we require, you know, the participation, the cooperative interaction with other species. But we don't need elephants. We don't need pandas. We don't need panthers any more than we needed bison and dodos and passenger pigeons to you know, perpetuate our own species' existence. The massive extinction event in progress right now is something which is so easy to ignore, and something which, you know, by necessity, we have to subordinate to other priorities. You know, more demanding, more immediate, more urgent priorities. I've been thinking, I can't say a lot, but it comes up often, you know, in my various readings and meanderings. Nuclear power. I have friends who are so opposed to nuclear energy that if you even try to engage them in a discussion of the various costs and benefits of employing it, they just get so angry that the conversation is impossible. And yet, in terms of the number of people who have died in the production of nuclear energy, it is clearly the safest form of generating electricity at a commercial scale. Far more people die falling from wind turbines than have died in the production of nuclear energy. That includes the Chernobyl disaster. One of Andrew Yang's policy proposals is to switch from uranium-powered nuclear energy to thorium-powered nuclear energy, and more specifically to molten salt thorium reactors, which represent a far safer paradigm for nuclear energy generation than, you know, what we've pursued in the past. And largely, you know, the U.S. pursued uranium as its nuclear power paradigm because it dovetailed with the creation of nuclear weapons, whereas thorium does not. An AI pioneer named Andrew Ng, it's just NG is his last name, had a famous quote. He said that worrying about the rise of killer robots is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. Well, at one point, nuclear energy and nuclear weapons technology was so advanced, so resource intensive, so esoteric, that for the U.S. military and for the portions of the U.S. federal government responsible for managing energy, the idea that proliferating nuclear weapons should be a worry was akin to worrying about overpopulation on Mars. And yet, here we are. Nuclear proliferation is a serious worry. Now, that is not to suggest that, you know, I'm particularly worried about the rise of killer robots. I'm absolutely not worried about the rise of killer robots. Although I do think that it is inevitable that autonomous weapon systems will be killing human beings without the direct oversight of human operators in the not too distant future. But it won't be because the robots have decided that humans need to die. It will be because other humans have tasked robots with the assignment of killing particular humans, and they will carry out that assignment with inhuman efficiency. I've been watching videos on YouTube made by a pair of guys. One is American, the other is South African, but they've both lived in China for a long time, and they just ride around on their motorcycles in China. And they have they're each wearing a GoPro camera on their helmets. They have an intercom system set up so they can talk by radio, you know, while riding, and they record those conversations. And I've spent a fair amount of time just basically watching the Chinese landscape scroll by as these two guys talk about their experiences in China. And, you know, we think of China as this emerging technological powerhouse and juggernaut, and there's certainly an aspect to that. But China is also a huge, huge country that is largely inaccessible. It doesn't have advanced transportation systems that reach most of the country, and most of the people living in China are still struggling with desperate subsistence-level poverty. And the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, has very good reason to fear a popular uprising and a backlash against their rule. So they are dedicated to continuing their impressive levels of economic growth. Although the peak oil people aren't wrong about everything, maintaining economic growth indefinitely, seems like a near impossibility. And so, you know, one of the Chinese Communist Party's most pressing agendas is social control. And they are turning, you know, the emerging sciences of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and brain science to the task of controlling their own population, shutting down dissent, managing opinion, punishing people who have the wrong thoughts and rewarding those people who have thoughts which are advantageous to the Chinese Communist Party. They are developing a very sophisticated suite of social control that I see no reason to believe will remain in China. They are also demonstrating just how easily capitalism and authoritarianism mesh. What a good fit that combination is. I think I've mentioned here on the podcast, certainly I have in the videos, the work of a geopolitical analyst who, to my mind, is as much a showman as he is a researcher. His name is Peter Zeihan. He's got a couple books that I've taken in as audiobooks recently, The Accidental Superpower and The Absent Superpower. And he talks a lot about China. And one place where his narrative seems to fall down is he thinks that the Chinese Navy is pathetic compared to the Japanese Navy. This is going to be, you know, very important in the coming contest for the control of the sea lanes, which bring Middle East oil to East Asia. But he treats that imbalance as if it were, you know, some fixed feature of the universe, which it certainly is not. And China is rapidly developing naval power, building aircraft carriers, jet fighters, building artificial islands on which to base missiles and fighter jets and all the ground-based support needed to support their growing navy. I think that the Japanese government understands what's happening in China, and they are making moves to beef up their own navy, but I don't think that they are as moving as quickly as China is. One of Peter Zeihan's contentions is that the United States is basically withdrawing from a lot of its global military commitments, slowly but steadily over the decades, pulling back, and that people who have for decades complained about the heavy hand of U.S. military imperialism are starting to feel insecure because they've depended on the U.S. military to keep the peace where they live, and they have, you know, only token militaries. Germany is a particular example of this. Japan used to be, but, you know, they've seen the writing on the wall, and they have been making efforts, you know, with U.S. encouragement to become more self-sufficient in terms of their military. And this has been going on for decades. I made mention of this in some video, and, you know, I'll put out a video, and then I forget about it. But then, slowly, over time, you know, new people discover it, and so not a constant stream, but an intermittent stream of comments on old videos comes to my attention. And somebody was pushing back against some of these Peter Zeihan-informed videos recently talking about China's control of rare earth minerals and how, you know, rare earth minerals are absolutely necessary for building electronics, electronics which are central to all of our military hardware now, basically saying that the U.S. military machine is dependent on China and that China could shut off the supply of rare earth minerals at any time. And the United States and China are in the midst of a trade war, and the Chinese Communist Party, through its state-owned media outlets, has been dropping subtle threats that they will actually restrict the export of rare earth minerals to the United States in order to retaliate against the U.S. for, you know, its trade war practices. Well, they tried that. Back in 2010, they tried that. And it didn't work. The total value of rare earth minerals imported into the United States every year, at this time anyway, is about $160 million. That is nothing. And what's more, China doesn't have any magical ability to recall all of the rare earth elements that are already embedded in our existing military hardware. All they could do is inconvenience the U.S. military in upgrading and building new hardware. The existing hardware is already in place. And what's more, you know, it's like lithium mining. I remember a couple of years ago, Chris Martinson said that, you know, we could never have an electric vehicle fleet because there's not enough lithium supply to you know, provide batteries for all of those electric vehicles. Well, that's not because there's an absolute scarcity of lithium. There isn't. It's a very common element. It's just that, you know, in the past, there wasn't that much demand for it, and the existing supply reflects past demand. But as the demand increases, the supply will increase because it is not a rare element. Well, the rare earth elements, by definition, are certainly more rare than lithium, but they're not all concentrated in China. It's just that production was concentrated in China. As they become more valuable, and particularly if China tries to restrict the supply, they are available from other sources. Getting around a Chinese ban on the export of rare earth elements would be an inconvenience. It might result in some price increases in consumer electronics, but for the most part, if it's not an issue that you care about and follow, you probably wouldn't even know that it was going on. And if I'm searching around for a theme that unifies all of these disparate topics, what I come up with is that our advancing technological prowess is ushering us into a period of extreme wealth creation, which could result in widely shared abundance and opportunity for everybody, but which, given our existing political and biological, psychological priorities, won't be. And that even amidst enormous wealth, maybe even particularly amidst enormous wealth, gross disparity, gross inequality within a society is not only corrosive, it not only breeds widespread resentment and distrust of essential institutions, but it's self-reinforcing. It feeds on itself. You know, a longstanding topic of interest for me is artificial intelligence, but in the past I was mostly concerned about, you know, the path to artificial general intelligence, so-called intelligence that would be equal to human intelligence, including, you know, having a sense of self, a personal narrative, desires for individual liberties, that sort of thing. All of that is way, way back on the back burner for me right now, because, you know, the traditional conception of the advancement of artificial intelligence was that artificial intelligence would first advance to human equivalent and then on to super intelligence. But that's not how it works. Artificial intelligence from the get-go, even before, you know, people were using that term, just information technology, information processing, it is superhuman in a limited domain. Before your smartphone ate the calculator, when it was a separate freestanding device that sat on your desk, and I know for some of you it still is superhuman in its ability to add, subtract, divide, find square roots, you know, depending on how sophisticated your calculator is, do a variety of other mathematical functions. It's already superhuman in those abilities. It's just that superhuman cognitive abilities are proliferating. They're just not unified right now. And I think the sooner they are unified, the better. But I see no indication that, you know, general intelligence is on the near horizon. But super intelligence in narrow domains is here. And that super intelligence is being directed to generating enormous wealth and concentrating it into fewer and fewer hands. And this is destructive to our society, to our civilization, and, you know, for the increasing number of us who are not in the group of, you know, the elite, or who don't feel like we're part of the elite. It is destructive to our sense of self-worth. It is destructive to our ability to look at the future with any sort of optimism. It is destructive to our ability to see the people around us as, you know, collaborators in the creation of a future worth inhabiting. The amount of political and cultural division in the U.S. right now, you know, in my 50 years of life, 51 years of life, I don't obviously have fully formed memories of all of those 51 years, but, you know, it goes back several decades. This is not the world that I'm used to. You know, one of the, I won't say regular guests, but, you know, repeat guests on the CROM podcast in the past is David Blacker. He is a university professor. He teaches in Delaware, although he lives in Pennsylvania. And he's written some books for Zero Books, the most recent of which is, I think it's called What's Left of the World. And in it, he talks about the proliferation of new identities. People are really invested in their identity in subcultures, you know, based on sexual orientation or, you know, their particular race or their particular form of disability or, you know, all manner of things, you know, what sort of media they like. And the animosity between these groups is growing. You know, groups which just didn't really have any sense of group identity a couple decades ago, people are now really, really angry at people who they see as being opposed to that identity. And, you know, the identities, they continually fracture into smaller and smaller sub-identities. And David Blacker's, you know, part of his thinking about this is that this is the result of the erosion of the ability to draw identity from their vocation. It used to be that, you know, your job provided you with a a very large part of your personal sense of identity. You are what you do. But in a world where fewer and fewer people have the sort of, you know, work life that you could plausibly invest your identity in, and, you know, in a world where more and more people are living precariously because they don't have any sort of stable relationship with an employer, vocation is just not a suitable anchor for personal identity for more and more people. And as a result, you know, people are looking elsewhere for anchors for their identity, but doing it in a way where, you know, they just don't understand the consequences of doubling down on the emotional intensity that you invest in a tenuous identity. It breeds anger. It breeds conflict. You know, of all the books that I've read and listened to in the last couple of years, the one that I think gives me the most plausible framework for an optimistic viewpoint about how humans are going to navigate the emergence of artificial intelligence, be it general intelligence or just, you know, splintered super intelligences in narrow fields, is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. And yet, even in that book, you know, the challenges that he identifies are daunting. And thinking back on the book now, I mean, it's been a very long time since I listened to it, although I did listen to it repeatedly. I don't remember anything that he said particularly which gives me hope in this, you know, this runaway proliferation of new identities and the hostilities and the cultural animosity and dysfunction that this process breeds. I don't remember him saying anything that gives me any sense of hope on that front, except maybe that in the future we will all have full-time personal psychologists in the form of AI, which are constantly helping us to reframe our experiences such that, you know, we're not just stewing in our own anger and resentment. And I don't recall him saying that specifically. That's something that I've extrapolated from what he did say in the book, which is basically that, yeah, we will have constant interaction with AI, which potentially could be devoted to, you know, helping us cope psychologically. But it could equally be harnessed for the purposes of amplifying cultural animosities, amplifying our sense of dissatisfaction, and further eroding any sense of solidarity that we have with the people who live around us or who we encounter online as disembodied avatars and representations and, you know, instantiations of viewpoints that we hate. And I haven't even touched on the problem of deep fakes. We have a president who dismisses any reporting of him which is unfavorable as fake news. Well, fake news, I mean, it's old. It's an established practice, but it's about to get very sophisticated and very ubiquitous. And not only are we not very good at reality testing, but we don't have much motivation to do it. We have great motivation to seek out voices, to seek out information which validates things that we already believe. But we don't have much motivation, for the most part, to seek out voices, to seek out arguments, to seek out sources of information which challenge our worldviews. And yet, moving into a deepfake future, we are absolutely going to need a new and robust set of intellectual tools for doing exactly that. All right, well, I think I'm going to leave off here. Communications that I get from members of my longtime audience, I value very highly. You know, sometimes I'll do a video where I'll get a lot of communication from people that I haven't heard from before, and it's typically very low-quality communication. But stuff that I get from people that I've been hearing from for years tends to be really excellent. And for the most part, it doesn't come in via the comments to podcast videos. And I realize that you know, the construction of the C-Realm website doesn't make that easy. But I would like to hear from you. So if you are one of the few who actually does navigate the maze of the C-Realm website to post a comment here, please, you know, please do that. Please continue to do that. And you can always reach me via email. My email address is kmo@c-realm.com. And then there's, you know, Twitter, Patreon, YouTube, and the C-Realm podcast discussion group on MeWe.com. I do chew through a lot of audiobooks these days. So if you know of an audiobook, something that is available through audible.com that you think would expand my thinking in some crucial dimension, please do send me a recommendation. Chances are I will follow up and take in that content. All right. That is all for this episode of the CROM Vault Podcast. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for sticking with me. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.